about composition of defects, if I'm right.
Thank you. Is it a 1 hour talk? 60 minutes? I think so. Okay. Well, thank you very much to the organizers for the invitation. I apologize for the terrible abstract. And I will start by doing something that I'm not really used to doing, but which is to like make a plan of the talk. I've seen lots of people do that. Try to. But I guess instead of linearly listing topics that will be covered in this talk, I will rather focus on the structure of the talk. It's going to be a sort of a tree structure. And at some point they sort of come together to something, and then maybe it sort of well, I don't know, continue. And I will just fill in this tree diagram as the talk goes, so as to sort of let you know where we are. Let's see. Oh, maybe I should, here, I'm going to also use this area to list my collaborators. Arthur Bartels and Christopher. No. Douglas. Okay. So that will stay up there. Okay. Suppose I have a ring, A, and I have a right module, M, and a left module, N. Then I can form the tensor product over that ring. M tensor over A with N. Sure enough. Now, suppose that I have a second ring. Instead of having two A modules, M and N, I have two rings, A and B, and I have a right A module, M, and a left B module, N. And I also have an isomorphism, F, between A and B. Then, given that data, I can again form the tensor product of M and N. So, I don't know what in that situation would be a good notation for it. I mean, I don't want to privilege A or B, so let me denote it like this. So what I actually mean is use F to equip, for example, M with the structure of a B module and then tensor over B, or equivalent, use F inverse to equip N with the structure of an A module and then tensor over A. Okay, so far it's pretty trivial. Let's say that instead of a map, an isomorphism between B and A, we have a Morita equivalence between the rings A and B. So now I have a Morita equivalence. What is a Morita equivalence? A Morita equivalence is a bimodule. I'm going to call it L. So it's a bimodule with a property that tensoring over A with L induces an equivalence of categories between the category of A modules and the category of B modules. Then, morally, this is the same thing as an isomorphism. I mean, it actually is an isomorphism in some suitable bicategory. And you want to make sense, or I want to make sense, of this tensor product, which is done using the identification of A and B provided by L. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, say that I had put A and B's in the other direction. So L would be a right A module, left A module, right B module. Then it would be kind of completely obvious. You would just take the tensor product of A with L over A with M with N. M tensor L tensor N over the respective rings. But I sort of rigged it so that you cannot do that. And so, well, instead of transforming M into a B module by tensoring, we have to use the inverse functor of tensoring, which is also the adjoint functor of tensoring in this case, since tensoring is an equivalence of categories. What is the adjoint of tensoring? It's HOM. So I'm going to take M and transform it into a B module by homing L into it. So a way of making sense of this expression is to say I'm going to take HOM from L into M. I've used up the A module structure of L and M, and I have a B module structure remaining that I use to tensor with N. That's a very asymmetric definition of this rather symmetric expression. I could have done it the other way. I could have said I will do M tensor over A with a HOM over B from L into N. Well, that's not really restoring symmetry. That's just like introducing an extra definition, which is the symmetrized definition, to see that those two things are actually the same. One way of doing it is to notice that they both admit maps from HOM L M, tensor L, tensor HOM L N. Let me put the correct symbols. This is a HOM over B, this is a tensor over A, this is a tensor over B, and this is a HOM over A. The maps going from this big expression here and there always exist, just evaluation. Either evaluate these two guys together to get here, or evaluate those two to get up there. And the fact that those two maps are isomorphisms is a reflection of the fact that this thing is a Morita equivalence. Okay. So this was this little branch of the talk. Okay, next topic, von Neumann algebras. So these are algebras over the complex numbers, equipped with an involution, antilinear involution, star. So it's a star algebra. And the prototypical example of a von Neumann algebra is the algebra of all bounded operators on a Hilbert space. So B of H, bounded operators on a Hilbert space H, which is just to say continuous linear operators from H to itself. And this example is actually universal in the sense that any von Neumann algebra can be embedded in B of H as a closed subalgebra with respect to some natural topology that exists on this B of H guy. So let's see. Any von Neumann algebra can be embedded as a closed, and that's a definition actually, subalgebra of B of H. I need to tell you which topology I'm using on B of H, and the topology is that of pointwise convergence. So B of H is a Banach space that equips it with a topology. This is not the topology I'm looking at. If I was using that, I would be, in fact, defining Cicero algebras. Von Neumann algebras are using a different topology. It's the topology of pointwise convergence. I mean, this is a mapping space, subspace of mapping space. We have the topology of pointwise convergence. With respect to pointwise convergence. Convergence. In operator algebra lingo, this is called the strong operator topology. Okay. What is a module for a von Neumann algebra? Well, a module is exactly a choice of such an H and such an embedding. Actually, it doesn't have to be an embedding. So it's a choice of an H and a choice of a map. A module is a choice for a von Neumann algebra A is going to be a map from A to B of H, a map of star algebras, which is continuous with respect to that topology. A bimodule is going to be when you have two module structures on the same Hilbert space. So if I have here a second von Neumann algebra, then let's call it, this is the problem. I want to call it B, but B is already taken. So I call it A2. And somehow this one was A1. If I have a second map going this way, where the images in B of H are commuting subalgebras, then it's a bimodule. Not quite. I need to take the opposite algebra because, well, the fact that I put the map going from the right actually didn't encode anything, it's just a map. So I really need to have the opposite algebra. So that's a bimodule for a von Neumann algebra. Two continuous homomorphisms of star algebras into, so H is a Hilbert space. Okay. So at this point, one might hope that the theory of bimodules that you know of and that you like from algebra, that all this theory goes over to von Neumann algebras. And in some sense, that's true. But in some sense, that's a little bit more complicated in the setup. And the first place where you notice that it's a little bit more complicated here is that, well, so here I have, say, rings, and here I have von Neumann algebras. And the first construction that you can do very easily in this setup is the construction of viewing R as an RR bimodule, where R is some ring. And if A is a von Neumann algebra, then you want to say that A is an AA bimodule. Unfortunately, this doesn't work for the very simple reason that A is not a Hilbert space. I said that you need a Hilbert space to have something that you call a module. So there's a fix to that. There's a construction of a Hilbert space canonically associated to every von Neumann algebra that goes by the name L2 of A. This is like L2 functions in a space is a way of turning a space into Hilbert space. And if you think of this as some kind of non-commutative space, then, well, you use the same notation. And that is an AA bimodule. Maybe I should give you some examples of what this construction L2 looks like. Let's see. Maybe I do it here. So if A is the algebra B of H, then the Hilbert space that you get is the space of all Hilbert Schmidt operators. On the same Hilbert space H. This is a subset of this big Banach space, which happens to be a Hilbert space. So some class of operators. If A is the algebra of measurable bounded functions on some measure space X, then what you get is the L2 functions on that same measure space. And in both cases, you can see that an L infinity function times an L2 function that remains an L2 function, Hilbert-Schmidt operators, that's an ideal inside the bounded operator, so there's an action actually on both sides. Anyways, the actual definition in general is kind of intricate, and it would be way off topic for this conference, so let me not go into details. Okay, but you might ask, actually, why do we care about this? What we actually care about is to have some good analog of the notion of tensor product, say of bimodules, of modules. And if that operation of tensor product is unital, then whatever the unit is, we call it this. It's going to be something. What you actually want is to have this equation, L2 of A. Let me use a slightly different symbol than tensor product because it's a slightly different operation than tensor product. You want this given any bimodule H, AD bimodule between von Neumann algebras, you want this to be the same as H. Actually as an AD bimodule. So there is an action of A here. And indeed, this such an operation exists. The name of this beast is Alain Korn's fusion tensor product. And and it satisfies that property and also the same property from the other side, and it's coherently associative and has all the nice things that you might like it to have. But if you sort of look at how the definitions actually look like, you realize that you cannot define this before knowing what that is. And I just wanted to actually tell you what confusion is because it's not so difficult. So once you set up things in the correct way, so suppose I have a right A module H, and left A module K, then this is defined as HOM over A from L2 of A into H tensor over A with K, and then often this turns out to be a Hilbert space. Sometimes you need to complete it in order to make it a Hilbert space. So this definition, if you like first see it like that, might seem very weird, but I have tried to motivate it by doing that story. So if you just take the algebraic tensor product of H and K, you just get something that you fail to be able to define an inner product on that. Which is, I mean, you can try, and it just doesn't work. And if you do that, then it's possible to define an inner product on that, and you can complete with respect to it. Okay. So let's see. This is, so I talked about von Neumann algebras. Told you that the bimodule L2 of A exists, even though I didn't tell you what it is, and confusion is where these two branches of the talk meet. So let me now sort of say in one word all the properties that this confusion satisfied in a sort of conceptual package. Well, there is a bicategory whose objects are von Neumann algebras, whose arrows are bimodules defined as above. The composition of arrows is given by this operation here. I mean, say if I have two extra algebras here acting, one acting on the left on H, one acting on the right on K, then H and K would be bimodules, and this thing here would also be a bimodule. So that's a composition of arrows, and it all fits into the language of a, into the package of the bicategory. So what we get is the units are these bimodules here. That is the unit bimodule for the this is a unit one morphism on the object A. And the two morphisms are just maps of Hilbert spaces that preserve the two actions. Continuous maps of continuous linear maps. So then we have a and I will call this bicategory VN for von Neumann algebras. Okay, so maybe a summary. So the objects are von Neumann algebras. The arrows are bimodules. Composition of arrows is confusion, and the two morphisms are maps. They're maps of Hilbert spaces preserving all the structure. I could expand a map of bimodules, but I think it's obvious what I mean. Okay. So time for a new topic. We'll hope to maybe connect a little bit to, let's see, to the subject of this conference. Okay, so here I have two parallel lines. One of them is the K theory, and the other one is PMF. So let's start and recall a little bit how it works. Given an elliptic curve E defined over some ring R, then you can form the following construction, which is given a topological space X, I will consider a complex subordism of X that is a module over the complex subordism of a point. Let's use that to tensor that with the ring R in a way that uses the data of the elliptic curve. So by a theorem of Quillen, mu star is a ring that classifies formal group laws, meaning group structures on a completed curve. Given an elliptic curve, I can complete it at its origin to form such a group structure, and this group structure will provide a ring map from mu star to R. So you use the elliptic curve to form this ring map, and then you change the coefficients. This forms a pre-sheaf of cohomology theories on the moduli space of elliptic curves, because for every elliptic curve I have built a homology theory. After a lot of work, you can transform that pre-sheaf of homology theories into a sheaf of spectra. I should list some names, I guess, in order. Michael Hopkins and Haynes Miller come into this play. Paul Gorse made a big contribution when they tried to make it all E infinity. Jacob Leary then came and redid it all. Many people have thought about that. So we get, at the end of the day, a sheaf of spectra on the moduli space of elliptic curves, and PMF is the global sections. Over this whole moduli space. So this is a spectrum, represents a cohomology theory called TMF. There's a very similar story with K-theory. If you take this and replace the elliptic curve by the elliptic curves E that came into this construction by GMs, by the multiplicative group, then what you get is that the same definition, namely mu star x tensor over mu star with let's say Z, where this map now is the completion of the multiplicative group, then that ends up being the same as the K-theory of X. So what you see is that there is a strong analogy between these two pictures. So let's write it here. There is a good analogy in the algebraic approach to TMF, and to can sort of make KCA in the same way. And what this lets us hope is that there might also be a good analogy in the analytical approach. And let's put some question marks, because the analytical approach exists for K-theory, but I think it's fair to say that it does not exist for TMF. So we're sort of trying, and many people are trying, and hope that one day this theory will come into existence. So how does it work for K-theory? A K-theory class on some space X, following, and now I'm going to sketch the Kasparov approach to K-theory. So the first thing that you need is a bundle of Hilbert spaces on your space X. Actually, let me write it directly here. So we have some a bundle of Hilbert space on our space X, and in the model that I like the most, these Hilbert spaces have to be Z2 graded, but let me not dwell too much on technical aspects. The next important feature that we have is a Fredholm. Operator on every fiber of this bundle. A Fredholm operator is an operator, both of whom kernel and co-kernel are finite dimensional. And so far that would actually define something, and that would be K naught of the space. But let's say we don't just want K theory in degree zero, we want all K theories, then you need to have one more ingredient, which is you need to have an action of the and Clifford algebra, the Clifford algebra on n generators, on each fiber of that bundle of Hilbert spaces and commuting with the Fredholm operators that were already there. And once you have that, this is a complete description of, this describes classes in K-theory and K of X, and if you put the appropriate equivalence relation, this actually provides a definition of K-theory. Stefan Stolz and Peter Teichner have spent a lot of time trying to think about what the corresponding story for TMF could be. And they don't have a complete answer, but they have a very big sketch. I mean, it's like much more than a sketch. It's like really substantial body of work that describes what could come on this side of the story. And and what they say is that instead of Hilbert spaces, one should consider von Neumann algebras. So they say, okay, a TMF class on X consists first and for all of a bundle of von Neumann algebras on the space X. These Fredholm operators, they reinterpret them as being infinitesimal generators for a one-dimensional supersymmetric field theory. And they're like, well, once you realize that, then the natural thing to do is to try to play with two-dimensional supersymmetric field theories. Okay, so let's write that down. Two-dimensional supersymmetric field theories. And if you believe the analogy, then this would only give you a description of TMF in degree zero, because that was only an analogy of a description of K here in degree zero. And you also need something that plays the role of Clifford algebras. And what they then said is, well, let's see Clifford algebras. These live in, maybe I should write down what the Clifford algebra is. Clif N, an algebra on N generators, E1, EN, such that EI square equals 1, EI, EJ equals minus EJ, EI. So these are algebras. In particular, they live in this bicategory of algebras and bimodules. Essentially, what you do to pass from this side to that side is whenever you see a number, you add 1 to it. So what they would want is some something in a 3 category, tri-category, in a suitably built tri-category that would play the role of Clifford, the same role as Clifford algebras do. And this led them to formulate the following conjecture. I mean, they had a lot of constraints as to what this three category should look like based on how it should fit with all the rest. And let me phrase this conjecture in a sort of weak form. There exists a symmetric monoidal three category, let's give it a name, C, such that, and the way it should fit with the rest of the story forced the following constraint on them, which is that the homes from the unit object itself in the three category, that should be this guy here, the bicategory of monomial algebras, bimodules, compositions given by confusion, and maps. And this is a symmetric monoidal two category where the monoidal structure is given by tensor product, so it makes sense to ask that this also be symmetric monoidal. Okay, so as stated, this conjecture is trivially true. You can just take the symmetric monoidal tree category with one object. And what do I need to tell you to give you this symmetric monoidal tree category? I need to tell you what is home from that one object itself. Well, that's it. And you're done, essentially. So let me qualify that that conjecture. There exists an interesting symmetric monoidal three category that that does that. I mean, in particular, you want one in which you have some interesting objects that would play the analogous role to Clifford algebras. I mean, they also have some requirements about what these objects satisfy, and the unit does not satisfy those requirements. Okay, so these guys and me, we have an answer to propose for that to that question raised by Stolzenteichner here. Where do I put it? Uh, Stolz and Pachner conjectured following. Yes. The definition of interesting. No, it doesn't occur in the definition of interesting. It's just a vague statement, like it should be interesting. I don't know. Yes, and Clifford algebras are objects in the two category of rings and bimodules. Well, so for example, Clifford algebras, if you do Clifford algebras over the real numbers, you can just write down the definition that's up there, and you will notice that after 8 steps, the 8th Clifford algebra is Morita equivalent to the ground field R, and that is just an explicit module, a finite dimensional thing that you can write down, and that, using the Kasparov model of K-theory, provides a proof of Bott periodicity, in the sense that, well, what is that? It's a bunch of Hilbert spaces with stuff and actions of these Clifford algebras. I can use these actions, tensor the bimodule, I will get the same kind of data with just a different action. This is all very present in the Atiyah Bott Shapiro paper from the early 60s. Yeah, I mean, it's more than braided monoidal. Yes, it's you need to trivialize it. It's like E infinity. Okay. Answer. The objects are these things that we call conformal nets. Arrows are these things that we call defects. Oh, sorry, we call. Are called. I mean, we didn't invent those. Are called defects. And to just give you an idea of what these are von Neumann algebras. Plus extra structure. The two morphisms are Hilbert spaces plus extra structure. And part of this extra structure is the structure of a bimodule over those von Neumann algebras that are up there. But you also need to like talk about that if you want to. And the three morphisms, so if I have one morphisms with same source and target, and then I have a two morphism here, and then a two morphism there. So you should view that as being some kind of globe. So here let's actually make it look three-dimensional, and then in the middle of that three-dimensional thing you have a little arrow pointing, let's say, down. These guys here, the three morphisms, these are some kind of maps of Hilbert spaces subject to a bunch of conditions. I mean, essentially commuting with all the actions that are prescribed by that extra data. Okay, so let me tell you a few things about, oh, let me go back and fill in this diagram. So here I have the Stolz-Tachner conjecture, and down there we're already talking about conformal maps. So what is a conformal net? Here's a partial definition. A net, which is just a shorthand for conformal net, is a covariant functor. Typically, I will call it by the letter A. From contractible, compact, oriented, one-dimensional, smooth manifolds. Okay, how many of them are there? These are, oh, I should, I allow boundary. yeah, these are, they're all just like the interval. Two von Neumann algebras. What are the morphisms in this category? I don't want to allow all maps. I only want to allow embeddings. But I do want to allow orientation reversing embeddings. So embeddings, and then if it's an orientation preserving embedding, then it will go to homomorphisms, so C-linear homomorphisms, let's just say maps, and if they are orientation reversing, they go to C-antilinear maps. And you could also rig the definition so that instead of C antilinear maps, you have, instead of antilinear algebra homomorphisms, you could also say linear algebra anti-homomorphisms, and you can go from one to the other using the star operation. So it's a sort of matter of choice of which one I put here. This is all the data of a conformal net. Then there are some conditions about which functors you allow, and that's where this definition is going to be partial, because I'm not going to tell you all the conditions, but I will tell you the most important ones. So whenever I have two intervals that are embedded in a bigger interval, then I want the subalgebras A of I and A of J to commute inside A of K. If I and J happen to cover K, then I want that A and I and A of J generate A of K. If they overlap, then the intersection goes to the intersection, and some more. Oh, maybe I should have said it. Embeddings of intervals go to monomorphisms of an ML algebras. Okay, so it's interesting to note that the, let's say, the underlying vector space of the conformal net, by which I mean take the standard interval 0, 1, evaluate the conformal net on 0, 1, you get a von Neumann algebra, and look at the underlying vector space of that von Neumann algebra. So let's think about that vector space. That vector space has two multiplications. One coming from the fact that it was a von Neumann algebra, it was an algebra, so that's an associative multiplication. A of the standard interval has two multiplications. One because it's a von Neumann algebra, that's an associative one. The and a second one coming from the fact that the interval is a coalgebra in topological spaces, if you want. It's like 0, 1 glued with 0, 1 is again something homeomorphic to 0, 1, and you can shrink it and put it inside 0, 1. So the map from 0, 1 union, where I glue over a point with, let's write it like that. 1, 2, 2, 0, 2. All these intervals are isomorphic to 0, 1. Use those isomorphisms, and then you will get a second multiplication, which is not associative. It's only a homotopy associative. Actually, it's a bit stronger. It is associative up to conjugation by a chosen element in this first multiplication. There exists an element, a God-given element, in this first which with respect to this first algebra structure will conjugate the two ways of associating three guys in this second multiplication. So because it's a Von Neumann algebra, you have one, and then you have a second one because the interval is a coalgebra. And all these together actually, this vector space is an algebra over a topological operad, which has the homotopy type of the E2 operad. Maybe I should say a little bit something about defects. Defects are bimodules, are things that, well, I said, they're Von Neumann algebra, so that's one structure, and then they're also bimodules with respect to this second multiplication. And a few months ago, when I was asked to give the title of this talk, I thought that, well, so what's the most interesting part of this bicategory of Von Neumann algebras? It's the composition of arrows. All the rest is sort of easily explained. That one requires to go into depth. Similarly, what is the most deep structure in the three category, it is the composition of arrows. It is the composition of defects. And I was like, oh, that's what I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to go all the way into the technicalities and like tell you all about it. Then I thought it was a terrible idea, so I didn't do it. But anyway, you get some flavor of what defects are. What I should probably do right now is give you a few examples of conformal nets so that you know what do you have in there? In particular, we need some examples for this particular construction. So conformal nets are one of the existing formalisms for talking about conformal field theory. And in particular, all the conformal field theories will give you examples of conformal nets. You have examples of conformal nets. You have, whenever you have a simply connected compact Lie group G, you can take its loop group, take the central extension choose the central extension by S1. To every one of them, there is an associated conformal net loop group. You might have heard of the moonshine conjecture, which was solved by constructing a conformal field theory on which the monster group acts. Well, that conformal field theory has an associated conformal net. On which the monster acts, such that the monster is the group of automorphisms of this conformal net. There's examples coming from integral lattices. Anyways, there's other stuff. But the one I care about is the one that's going to be useful up there. It goes by the name free fermion. And I will give a very sketchy definition of what the free fermion is. Well, what is it? It starts with an interval I. And you want to build this Von Neumann algebra. You do it in two steps. First, you take, let me start more on the right of this. First, I'm going to take L2 of that interval. That's a Hilbert space. It has a bilinear pairing, which I can use to build a Clifford algebra. The Clifford algebra of this Hilbert space. Well, that's not yet a Vonnegut algebra, that's just an algebra. And you need to pick a representation in which to complete it, in which to close it, to make it into Vonnegut algebra. That's called the Fock space. So this Clifford algebra acts on some Fock space, complete with respect to that, with a topology of pointwise convergence on bounded operators on the Fock space, and that is what the free fermion will assign to this interval I. Then you take powers of the free fermion, and the nth tensor power of the free fermion looks pretty good for controlling degrees in TMS. But I think I have run out of time, so I will stop here. Thank you. I have formulated a conjecture which says that the free fermion is periodic with period 576. And I have presented that conjecture to a bunch of people doing conformal nets, and they have nothing to say about it. yeah. So. It is not one of those numbers that physicists recognize as being, oh, yes. Sure, I can do that actually relatively quickly. Given an interval I will construct a group which is the maps from I into G. And I will not take all maps, I will take maps with the property that they restrict to the identity element on a small neighborhood of the boundary. So they're base maps, and they're actually a little bit more base than usual base maps. So maps, base maps. There are two base points that need to go to the base point there and actually a neighborhood. Okay, this group embeds in the group of all, in the free loop space, by essentially what you need to do is once you have your circle, you sort of pick one half of the circle and say that half will have this interesting map and the other half will go to nothing. Then you use, so I have a representation of this group, centrally extended group on the vacuum Hilbert space at level L for the loop group. So act on some vacuum rep of the free loop space. And then you generate an algebra, and then you complete just like I did over there in with respect to this strong operator topology to build a Vonnegut algebra. And this turns out to satisfy all the axioms. The vertex algebras is another of the existing formalisms for talking about conformal field theory. And actually, people have conjectured that there's a sort of one-to-one correspondence between vertex algebras subject to some unitarity conditions and conformal nets. And there are some partial results, but people don't really know how to do that. So yeah, people expect the things to really line up. And the representation theory of the vertex algebra to be identical to the representation theory of the conformal net. Oh, by representation theory, I mean the stuff that comes at the level of two morphisms. So, yeah. But the axioms look different, so it's difficult to actually do it.